Accession number 10180, rule 10.
Mr. John Hatfield, Reel 10. I wonder if you could tell me how you went about your duties then. You said you went out on voyage, yes. on trips. Could you continue?
Well, when there was a patrol due, there was a procedure under which there was a briefing meeting, same as in the British flotillas. The officers in the captains and the second in command of the boats who were due to go out would meet with the senior officer. The latest briefing received from the Admiralty and from the local RN command would be read out and discussed. Tactics would be discussed. Whether one had to work with other units or not would be discussed, and so on. And there was quite a good radar watch and general intelligence watch kept by the Admiralty on what was going on the other side of the channel. On the whole, information was quite good. So then one would take off, one would set out, usually round about dusk, in order to get over to the other side in darkness. And the drill was you were supposed to... the drill was that we set out in the dusk... the drill was, having got to the other side, you would wait in silence with the engines off and just listen, hoping you'd hear the enemy come and see them. And of course a lot of the time you didn't. So the first patrol I went out like that, we spent something like 18 hours with nothing happening at all. Another time we went very close to Saint-Malo, which was at that time being bombed, and I think I mentioned this before, the fat officer who got me drunk the first night I arrived had his family in Saint-Malo. And when we got back for the next few days, he was in a terrible state of depression, understandably, got quite drunk. One incident I remember was when we were out on a big operation under the command of a British destroyer in conjunction with some American PT boats, American gunboats, actually.
Do you know the date of it?
This was the 6th of August, 1944. And I remember that Peter Scott was either in command, or more likely in command of the coastal forces part of the operation, I would say. This was a big combined attack in which the Americans actually hit two enemy armed trawlers. But it was over quite a big area of sea. We didn't actually hit anything ourselves, but we were part of a sort of small-scale strategic operation, with a tremendous amount of tracer being fired and signal rockets and on, and really quite brilliant and nice to look at. That felt exciting because it was something bigger than we normally did. But soon after that, the flotilla was sent to the French side to a little harbour, a little fishing harbour called Abervrac, which has since become quite a well-known rendezvous for yachtsmen from Britain. But in those days was a tiny little fishing village. The idea was that we would be based there in order to operate against any German ships in the area, because this was a big pocket where the Germans had stayed after the retreat from Normandy. It was a big area from Brittany right down to the Spanish coast, Spanish frontier. And I remember going on in a car which we commandeered or borrowed, and looking at the American troops who were besieging Brest, my first experience of a land operation. And it was again just like a film, huge areas of abandoned rifles and rubbish of all kinds that had been devastated, and you could see the town in the near distance, which was pretty well destroyed. The combined effort of the Germans and the American bombardment had more or less reduced it to rubble. There was a great feeling among the people in the area that the Americans had overdone it. There was no need to destroy the place, that they were being ham-fisted, etc.
They said that to you, didn't
yeah.
they?
Yes, we got that very strongly from the locals.
How? What about from the Free French themselves?
The Free French, the same, yeah, because they couldn't help seeing it. It was their country, and couldn't help reacting against this. After all, Brest was the equivalent in France of, say, Devonport or Portsmouth. It was even bigger. It was one of the big naval bases, and many of them had actually served there before the war, and certainly knew it very well. And many of them came from that area because we had a very high proportion in the flotilla of Bretons, seamen from Brittany, who provide a big proportion of French naval personnel. Anyway, the other aspect of life in La Bervraque then was that we were received as heroes. We were the first free French forces that the locals had seen. And although we hadn't actually liberated them, because the Germans had left as a result of the siege of Brest, the locals treated us as if we had liberated them. We had a great time. The officers were given the free run of the only proper hotel in the area, and the men were looked after equally by a lot of other people in cafes and restaurants and so on. We at that time were living on board ship, which you weren't supposed to. They were really too small to live in for long, so we spent as much time as we could ashore as guests of all the locals.
Where did you live on board ship? I mean, you wouldn't...
I just fitted in as an extra where I could in the wardroom. There were really two proper bunks, but they were folding, and you could actually sleep underneath one of them, I think, as far as I remember, if you tried hard enough. But most of the time, while we were in La Bervraque, we slept in the hotel.
Did you always go on the same boat?
No. I had two or three special friends, and I used to try and go with them if I could. But otherwise, I went on anyone who was willing to take me.
What would you do when you went out on... What was your... I mean, you were fairly excess to requirements in one sense.
Yes, I didn't do anything. I just was there, trying to maintain a kind of feeling of solidarity between the British Navy and the French. And, of course, I was always thinking that if there was an action and somebody got killed, I could then take over their job. I used to have rather infantile sort of fantasies about doing something heroic in that way. But also, I had to see to it that the telegraphists, who were British, were doing their job, and that if any messages came through, the French understood them properly, and the other way around, if they were passing messages back, that they were done properly. Because although they spoke quite good English by that time, you had to be sure that everything was clearly understood.
Did the 17 telegraphists, did they speak any French?
Not very much, no. Very few. I tried to give them lessons in French at one time, but it wasn't very popular. No, on the whole, they didn't. Only just odd phrases. You can get on with a sort of mixture of odd phrases and words in English and French, if you know each other. But
Did they mix well with the French crew?
Yes, they did, and they all liked them very much.
There was no problem then.
No, I never found any. And in fact, since then we've had a few reunions. At which we managed to trace two of the telegraphists, and they've all been delighted to see the French again, and vice versa. No, they all got on very well.
You say you did nothing. Would you be on the bridge?
I did nothing official. I used to share in the watchkeeping. I used to be on the bridge the whole time and share in the keeping lookout, generally. That was the main thing, keeping a good lookout. So that... I was acting as a sort of extra officer of the watch, if you like.
Would you keep lookout with binoculars?
Yes, with binoculars, and listening very carefully.
Did you ever see anything or hear?
No, I regret to say we never did. The time I was there, and nothing very near. We didn't actually have any fierce encounters at close quarters in that period when I was on board. Later on, there was more activity, but. That doesn't mean that they weren't doing a useful job. It's just that at that particular time we didn't run into any convoys.
When you were you stayed up to 18 hours. Was that 18 hours at sea or 18 hours with your engines off waiting?
No, a total of 18 hours. For instance, supposing you left at dusk, you came back something like 18 hours later in the And then you were absolutely worn out and had an enormous breakfast, went to sleep. Once or twice we were issued with benzodrine tablets to keep us awake. I remember I tried them once, thinking that was rather a wrong thing to do, and it has a very nasty effect. It makes you awake, and then you can't go to sleep when you come back, so on the whole, we didn't like them.
Was that... did most people not take them?
Yes, most people didn't take them, in the same way that most people didn't wear their life belts. In fact, all the time I was at sea, I very, very rarely saw people actually wearing their life belts, although you were supposed to. And we were even issued with sort of armour-plated waistcoats, which we were supposed to wear in action. And we were supposed, in fact, to wear them when there was a danger of action. But there again, nobody did. They were draped over various things.
Why didn't you wear these various safety devices?
Because they were uncomfortable. It just shows the way people reason. I've always thought that discomfort and embarrassment are stronger emotions than fear, even. And partly because it seemed cowardly to do so. You know, it seemed sort of as if you were being fussy, a bit kind of undignified.
So, after the capture of Brest,
yeah.
What happened then?
Well, I think it was before Brest actually fell. The flotilla was transferred from Dartmouth, which was still its proper base, to New Haven, which is nearer France. And we there were based again on the railway station, which was damaged by an explosion at sea while we were there, and one or two of the officers were slightly wounded by glass. And then, from there, we were allowed the first leave in France that the men had had, because when we were in La Bérac, they weren't able to go on leave. Quite a large number of the ratings, particularly, went to France to find their relations. And that was disastrous for their morale. It was very interesting. All the 4 years they'd been in England, more or less, since the fall of France, completely isolated and from their families. Most of them very young, although some were older, some were old merchant navy or naval people. And I'd like to talk about that later. And their morale was fantastic. They were cheerful, lively, humorous. They were a really amusing and interesting bunch. When they went to see their families, they came back shattered. Not because of the families, but because the atmosphere was so awful in France. It was defeated. There was nothing to eat. Everything was shabby and dirty. And there was a general atmosphere of hopelessness and kind of giving up, which hurt them terribly. So then it took some time to get their spirits up again. And soon after that, we moved to La Bérac, finally. The whole flotilla was transferred to La Bérac, and then to Brest, after Brest had been slightly cleared. And we occupied the German submarine shelters, which had been bombed by the RAF endlessly, so they were in a terrible mess. And then they'd been sabotaged by the Germans, who'd thrown every kind of rubbish they could think of inside them. And we had to clear all that away from part of it to use as the base for ourselves. Our flotilla did, yes. And that was interesting, depressing, a sort of German mess, you know, real depressing, wet filth, oil, rubbish everywhere. Gigantic underground concrete shelters with offices and workshops in them. We occupied part of it. I occupied a little office where I found a small German typewriter, which I kept for years afterwards. And that was my office, and so on. And we operated from there, down the coast, in conjunction with the resistance, clearing pockets that the Germans still occupied south of Brest, gradually going down the coast.
What did you have a role in that?
My role was still supporting the Free French and making sure they had everything they needed. For instance, before we left New Haven, I helped the senior officer to make out a list of equipment and stores that he needed, which the Navy still agreed to give him. We went through a manual of what people of different ranks are allowed to have, but unfortunately there wasn't one for motor torpedo boats, so I had to sort of compromise between a senior officer of a destroyer flotilla, which was a much bigger thing, and some sort of imaginary concept. For instance, I remember thinking, is he entitled to have silver cutlery, which was in the manual, or isn't he, and this kind of thing. My job at that stage was to make sure that they had supplies from Britain, because France had nothing.
Can you remember the nature of any of the, in any more detail of these supplies that you were responsible for allocating?
Well, they were the complete supplies needed to feed and keep operational the whole seagoing flotilla, and the base, which the French had a base of mechanics and all kinds of technical people, and they took that with them. So we had to provide everything that they would need, which beforehand was supplied by the British bases. So I relied there on lists that were given to me by the chief mechanical officer, engineer officer. It included supplies, because there wasn't much to eat in France, and so on. Included great barrels of wine, because the French were entitled to half a litre of wine per man per day. And I don't think we had rum. I got a horrible feeling that our telegraphists were done out of their rum. They were given wine if they wanted it, but they didn't, on the whole, like it. So, after a while, and this
did,
was...
Did you have any trouble getting these things
yes,
out of the British authorities?
Yes, I was beginning to be regarded by the British as a kind of French agent by that time, because I was making very strong demands on behalf of the French. I felt that they needed to be well supported and well supplied. And we overdid our list a little bit, purposely. It gradually got whittled down, and there was a good deal of arguing, but not unpleasant, and in the end they got most of what they wanted. I remember going down to somewhere near Portsmouth, where the base staff had been sent by this time, and a special train was put together to take it to the embarkation point to go over to Brest. And I was in charge of the train. I remember it was the only time in my life when I stuck my head out of the window and sort of not exactly blown a whistle, but told the driver to go off. And we went off with all this stuff, and it was landed on the other side. And thereafter, I had to keep in touch. I had to go to the Admiralty once or twice from Brest to make sure that some vital piece of equipment was provided. I remember going in Whitehall through the old Admiralty building and actually talking to somebody and saying, we need whatever it was, some small piece which was holding everything up. I think a foot pump.
What was the Admiralty? You were the liaison
yes.
officer. What was the relationship like? What did the Free French think of the Admiralty and their slight obstructionism? And what did the Admiralty think of the Free
yeah.
French? And their
well, at that stage, everybody's feelings were getting a bit tensed and complicated. The sort of heroic simple days were over. It was getting more complex. The French sometimes thought the British Admiralty were giving them less than they ought to have. For instance, a new kind of radar came in called IFF, Identify Friend or Foe, which was a special thing which picked up frequencies of aircraft. And with that, you could tell if an aircraft coming near you was an enemy or not. Now, the French heard of this and thought they ought to have it, because they wanted everything up to date, new, and so on. The British were annoyed because they weren't supposed to know about it. And I was sort of caught in the middle. And
why weren't they supposed to know about it?
Well, partly because it was very new and, I think, super secret, and also because very few British boats had it. And so they thought, if the British boats haven't got it, why should these French have it? The French line was, we've got to protest and ask for everything we want, otherwise we won't get anything. So that's how it worked. And I had to act as a kind of diplomat in between. Since I was only 22, it was quite interesting. It gave me delusions of grandeur, because whenever I had jobs after that for years, I always felt they weren't as interesting as that job had been. So that's how it was. And once we went over to France, to Brest, and with most of what they needed, they were then quite grateful. They felt the British Navy had treated them well. And years later, when I met again, and there was a little speech from the senior officer commemorating all this, he stressed how he and I had drawn up this famous list in one evening's work of what they needed, and we had telephoned it through, and we had got it without a single piece of paper and without anybody signing anything. And this is what's remained in his mind, how marvellous the British were, you know, that they trusted them. So...
Was that true, though? It didn't sound like the British Navy.
No, it was on the whole. Yes, I suppose somebody signed something later. But on the whole, things were done quite well, if you got hold of the right people.
Now, the other thing you had to do was to report on French morale.
Yes.
Would you make out a report, for instance, after that time when they came back from leaving France, would you write back to the Admiralty?
No, I think what happened was that I wasn't told I had to do this until after that. And the time I wrote, I think I only wrote two. I wrote one just before we went back to Brest, and mostly it was about the officers. But I did mention this question of morale and so on. And one strange thing that happened to me was that a little after that, when I was in Britain on one of my trips there, I met some senior officers who had read this report. I think it was their job to do this in the Admiralty. And one of them said to me, "Have you ever thought of being a journalist?" And I said, "Well, possibly, you know." He said, "Well, after the war, if you want a job on the Times, come and see me." And I thought, God, I'm made, you see. But I never did. But it showed that they thought the reports I'd written were quite interesting. And in fact, they were like a kind of character study. I wrote a little piece on each officer, or each main one, about their history, their background, their attitude, and so on.
Well, can you remember now, I was going to move on at some point to the main characters you got to know amongst a free French. That would seem to be the ideal time.
All right. Well, they were very, on the whole, a very interesting lot, very impressive. The senior officer I've already spoken of. The second in command was a canal pilot, Suez Canal pilot, who was in French Merchant Navy Reserve, Merchant Navy and in the Reserve. He was a bit older than a lot of them, rather a humorous, cynical type, married to an English woman. The senior officer was unmarried. And then most of the other officers were very young, although one or two were regulars. Most of them were not. And a lot of them had escaped from France in their teens and come over to England in order to join de Gaulle. One had escaped in the local lifeboat, which he'd commandeered with some friends. Another one had escaped with a friend in a little boat, and literally a page of a school atlas to guide him. He somehow made his way to Britain. Another one, whom I made friends with perhaps more than some of them, found his way to a ship after the fall of France, which was taking Polish soldiers on board, and smuggled himself among them and got landed in Britain. So they had actually learned their trade as officers in Britain. And they were quite pro-British. They enjoyed being in Britain. They had their own little jokes and sort of... I remember Popeye, the column of Popeye in some newspaper was a great favourite because they thought it was very funny. And they didn't like English food very much, but they got used to it. We were very lucky because in Dartmouth, particularly, we had a very nice officers' mess, a small hotel on the water's edge, which I think is still a hotel, which had been taken over, and we had a number of Wren's stewards to look after us with a petty officer Wren, who were charming, extremely nice, and they were really like sisters. When we used to go out on patrol, they always used to stand there and wave at us as we went by and this kind of thing. So they felt looked after and at home, and they admired the British. They felt this sort of British naval atmosphere of rather calm, humorous, not terribly excitable atmosphere was quite admirable. And we used to go in our spare time riding. We found a riding school. We used to go riding in our sea boots, and we used to go to Torquay for one of the officers was a great ladies' man. We used to sort of see him with a new woman every night. Things like that. We just enjoyed ourselves quite a lot.
How did you get on with the crew that you met, the French, the actual...
Quite very well, because I liked them, and I've always been pro-French, and so it was quite exciting to me to be with them. And although I didn't get to know a lot of the crew personally, I knew them quite well. And strangely enough, in these reunions I mentioned, which have taken place quite lately, one or two of them, who were in the crew then, have said that they liked me because I used to talk to them, whereas the other liaison officers didn't very much. Well, I suppose I did. I just enjoyed being with them.
How did you compare? You'd been on a British MTB, not for long, but you had.
Yes, oh yeah.
How did you compare the way the boat was run and the efficiency with which the boat was run with a British MTB? Or is that an unfair comparison?
No. Well, I was serving in a British MTB a short time, but I was mixing with MTB people quite a lot, British ones. The difference was that the French were more informal, much more informal. the relationship between the officers and the men was much less passer, if you like. And, of course, in the British MTBs, it was more informal than in big British ships. So the French were at one extreme. It wasn't inefficient by any means. They were probably less careful about scrubbing decks and all that kind of thing. But they worked very well. They were very keen that the engines should work well, that the gunnery should work. They were very, very action-oriented, extremely keen. They really did feel they wanted to prove they were better than any British flotilla. And not only than the British, better than the Dutch, the Americans, the Canadians, because there were a lot of foreign flotillas around in that part of England. We were quite friendly with the Dutch flotilla, for instance.
How did you yourself compare them with these other flotillas and the British flotillas? Did you think they achieved their aim, or did you think they were just as they got to a good standard, which was indistinguishable?
I think they were superior to some of the British in this burning desire to attack and to do well. I mean, the British had a tremendous action-oriented morale. I'm not saying the French were more dedicated to winning the war, but they were more personally involved in proving that they were a little tiny group who could be more active and better. And of course it's a matter of national characteristics that the French have always been famous, and it's not just a cliche, for what they call élan, for sort of driving on very fast and going ahead at full speed and attacking, see. The British tended more to be a bit cooler about it all, while being just as aggressive underneath. So it was a matter of atmosphere, I think. But they were very good, extremely
good. What about
good.
Their gunnery navigation skills?
The technical
skills.
Side.
Were they as good at gunnery? Or did you not have a chance to see them practicing?
I think some of the individual men manning the guns were as good as any other. I think perhaps their training wasn't quite as rigorous as the British. They relied more on a kind of instinctive drive and not quite so much on constantly repeating drills. But the new senior officer did force them to do an awful lot of practices, and he was very demanding in manoeuvres, for instance, making sure that they followed him, followed the leading boat, that they did everything very efficiently. So it was a kind of efficiency based on a corporate spirit, not just based on constant practice. But it's very difficult to compare.
Did they have any different tactics or procedures from the British?
No, they were very much the same. They followed what they'd learned in the British British training schools. Yeah. Of course, the method of operation changed to some extent after we went over to Brest and were based in France, and to some extent more integrated into the French Navy, whom they despised, incidentally. They very much despised the Vichy French who'd stayed behind and who now tried to tell them what to do. But their tactics had to change because we were operating in conjunction with the resistance, even sometimes going ashore and conferring with resistance leaders at local level and so on. Therefore, they weren't just operating against enemy convoys. They were both guarding against Germans breaking out. Hitler was supposed to be trying to break out to South America, and we were supposed to stop him. And they were also trying to clear the sea lanes to weaken the German presence on the shore,